Hi, welcome to another Writers After Dark. We're here because good stories start with the writers, since wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. I'm your host, Summer Brooks, and with me today is epic fantasy author David Dalglish, and we are going to talk about his latest book, the first in a new series. The series name is The Vagrant Gods, and the book is called The Bladed Faith. Hi, David.
Hello.
I have to ask, the sheer number of epic fantasy titles you have written is impressive. And I was there a specific catalyst for the epic fantasy as being, well, your writing wheelhouse?
Ironically enough, the first ever published like short stories and stuff I did were, one was sci-fi and another was horror on these little like tiny e-zines. But epic fantasy was generally what I liked to read the most, and it's what I liked to overall write the most. I've been writing terrible little epic fantasy novels all the way back to like eighth grade on like handwritten notepads and stuff like that. So like it was just kind of what I enjoyed. And probably most importantly, when I first looked into self-publishing all the way back in 2010, I believe, I actually had what was effectively a trunked novel that I didn't think I had any shot to traditionally publish, that I just kind of kept around. And then when it seemed like self-publishing might actually be a viable alternative, I had something I could start with, and then just continued on from that initial story I uploaded, and as I found success, I just kept going.
Was there anything in the feedback or the comments from the readers who were finding your stories and enjoying them and obviously continuing to buy them that encouraged you, that said, yeah, maybe I can keep doing this?
Oh yeah, no, when I very first started, I was absolutely, I had gotten a Kindle. And I was like reading so much in the Kindle. I was like, this thing's going to be huge. And this is, like I said, 2010. This is just before self-publishing really took off and everyone kind of realized just how viable and profitable it could be. So I was like, this is going to be huge. I'm going to be kicking myself forever if I don't at least make the attempt. And my wife actually looked into it and she came to me. She's like, hey, because something to bear in mind is I was, like in college, I actually had some creative writing courses. And I had one teacher who spent a day going over like the business aspects of publishing. And there was a discussion on self-publishing. And at that point, she was like, if you self-publish, it is almost certainly going to be the end of your trade career because no one will take it seriously. And almost every self-publishing company out there is likely going to scam you and try and just make money off of you because you're not going to actually sell anything and you're not going to be in bookstores. And at the time, she was mostly right still, to be fair to her. So my wife actually looked it up. Was like, actually, no, there's no cost to self-publish on Amazon whatsoever. It's only a royalty cut. I was like, oh, it's digital, so I don't need to mass order copies. I don't need to try to hand sell them. All right. So I basically, over the course of like 2 weeks, I edited and formatted basically in a mad dash in like an attempt to like outrun my terror and doubt that like no one was going to like it and this was a huge mistake. But I had this novel that had like elves and orcs and high fantasy magic and all these things I'd read that publishers didn't want. It was very D&D flavored and it was way too long. It was like 180,000 words, I think.
Wow.
At the time, which like first time author, if you go looking up, like how long should a first time author's book be? And then it's way longer than 180, or way shorter than 180,000. So I like took that and chopped a third of it into like 60,000 and just put that 60,000 up as the weight of blood. And then about like a month and a half, 2 months later, got the other half of it out as cost of betrayal. And then technically at that point, I already had what was effectively the third book. I had already written most of that by the time I had kind of stopped and assumed it was all hopeless. So I got that edited and up, and that was The Death of Promises, and I got that one out again about 2-3 months later. So right when things were starting off, I got three novels, just 1, 2, 3 out super fast. And I remember messaging my brother freaking out because I had like, it was one day I had 3 sales in the same day. And I was just like, oh my gosh, that's 3 people that bought my book in the same day. That's incredible. People are like actually reading this. And it just steadily kept growing. And the more books I put out there, the more, like, every time you put out a new book, it helps out the older books with visibility, with interest. You know, some people see a book 4 that's on a sales chart, they generally will glance at and wonder what book 1 is. And just like that, I just kept going and got very lucky with the timing and kind of got swept up in what was effectively a massive boom from about 2011 to 2013.
So what was the catalyst for the jump to traditional publishing?
So about, gosh, it's been so long, I have to try and get the years right. I wasn't originally thinking about going trade publishing. And eventually, this is a story I've gone over, I'll try and keep it short. I basically signed on to an agency located in Spain that offered to do a Spanish translation of my most popular book, A Dance of Cloaks, as well as represent me for any potential foreign offers. And I made sure that I retained the English rights, but I actually took that translation offer and applied to several agents. Like, well, maybe I can get an agent. I was like, here's my sales. Here's an offer for translation. Are you interested in being my agent? And I got turned down by several agents. So I was like, all right, I have an offer for translation on the table. Some good sales. Still don't have any agent interest. I'm not going to, trade is not in the works, whatever. I'm doing great. Self-publishing, this is perfectly fine. Like, I was at that point, my only goal for self-publishing was to make more than I made when I worked at Pizza Hut. So like, I was not aiming high here. I just wanted to avoid returning to Pizza Hut, which self-publishing was thankfully doing. But then that Spanish agency, like, I signed on a really, really, really awful predatory royalty rate, ooh, which I knew was predatory at the time, but I didn't care because I was like, whatever, it's for some random translations. Like, a tiny part of my ego was like, hey, I could tenderly have a foreign translation. Who cares if the royalty rate split was 50% for the agency, which that's not standard. and then without telling me, this agency pitched to Orbit and got an offer back. So I actually had no intentions of signing with Orbit. And then suddenly I was told they had a deal from Orbit on the table. I was just like, I'm sorry, what? And it was a lot of money. And I was just like, I can't, I've got a 50% and I wasn't even playing in this. I was like, all right, we need to renegotiate down to what is actually standard, because all my other writer friends are calling me an idiot and asking if I was insane for signing that. And they refused and played hardball and were incredibly unprofessional and were telling me how I was making their like agents there cry and stuff. They're shut down now, by the way, which is great. And eventually said they might reconsider, then changed their mind and basically said, it's 50%. Do you want the deal with Orbit or not? And I was like, no. I told them to walk. So long story short, that terrible agency had nothing to do with me, but also had signed a clause to where I could not get out of it for 5 years. Cue again, the me being an idiot and all my writers looking at me aghast. Wow. So eventually about 2 years later, the man who actually is my agent now, who I did not know was an agent at the time, because I knew him from writing circles. And he just suggested, like, have you tried to buy out your contract? Like, no. So I just sent a message to them. I hadn't talked to them in like a year and a half. It's like, hey, it's obvious you're not doing anything. Can I just buy out the contract? And they're like, how much? So I sent a number that was like way, way, way lower than I'd be willing to pay. And they countered like barely above it. I was like, oh, I can actually escape this. So basically I bought out my contract and then contacted who's now my agent. I was like, hey, I'm out. And since you revealed to me you were an agent in disguise instead of just a self-published author as well, are you interested in representing me? He was like, well, here, send me your book. I'll read it and then I'll decide. He read it. He liked it. He was like, yeah, sure. Okay. He's like, well, let's see if Orbit's still interested. So then 2 years later, after the original offer, we came back again, was like, hey, we have different representation now. Do you want this series? Which at the time had been just Dance of Cloaks and the first two. And after those 2 years, I'd actually continued it. And they're like, well, it looks like you've written more books. Is it no longer a trilogy? I'm like, well, no, nah, it's gonna be about six books. Like, okay, well, we want all six. And that was basically my road to traditional publishing, going back to them after initial offer, after having been self-publishing by that point, 3 years, something like 3 years. And by that point, I had done 3 straight years of all of the editing, all of the, you know, contracting cover arts, all of the trying to produce 3 or 4 books a year to keep up the pace that I started with in the very first year, and basically was just burning out and exhausting myself. So everyone talks about how traditional publishing is slower, and at the time I was like, that sounds fantastic. Having and everyone's like, oh, but you have to listen to other editors and they'll be in charge of your cover art instead of you. And I was like, again, this sounds fantastic.
That whole story sounds like some Hallmark Channel level of just plot twist shenanigans.
I've gone into it in a lot more detail, but it basically boiled down to me just being an idiot and that, you know, I had always assumed I'd never be published. So here's this, you know, awful, awful terms, but at the same time, I was like, no, well, 50% of something's better than 0% of nothing, right? Right? Yeah.
It's like
I did contact a lawyer to see if we could break the contract. And they said it was actually so terrible that there was a chance that we could try to in court, but it'd be so expensive and awful, and that they were a Spanish company, so we would have to try and get it done in US court. And even if we tried, most publishers would probably not want to touch it for fear of, you know, getting sued in Spain. But I did have a lawyer in New York actually read over the contract, and not exaggeration, call me an idiot for signing it. Just leaving an email, why were you so stupid as to sign this thing? I'm like, I know I'm paying you and all, you at least try and be nicer about me being an idiot.
word of warning, kids, do not try this at home.
Word of warning, get people you know to look over things like contracts that you trust and then listen to them and don't let your ego override things, because that's how so many predatory operations survive. They make you think they're offering you some amazing thing, and then you want it to be true so bad you ignore advice of people who are smarter. Like I knew what I was doing. I didn't even show the contract to some of my fellow writers because I knew they would look at that and tell me, what are you doing?
Well, your new book, The Bladed Faith, is the first in a new series called The Vagrant Gods. And Cyrus has some problems. Why don't
A
you
few.
tell us a little bit about Cyrus's journey that we're embarking on in this book?
So I guess this is technically some spoilers for chapter one.
Okay.
But the story opens with he's grown up on the island of Finette, and it's just way outside the normal reach of the greater continent of Gadir. Like it's like a 3 month voyage to get an idea of just how far out. And he's just always been told that they have like the greatest armada and the mightiest, you know, sea forces that exist. And he opens the novel watching an invasion from an empire on the mainland, basically proving he's delusional and been lied to. His fleet has been destroyed, soldiers are landing on the docks, and he just basically knows nothing about what is on the mainland, who these forces are, the empire that's invading, the Everlord Empire. He's heard only the most basic rumors about them, as like a few days prior, like rumors and whispers of like, hey, we think there might actually be a huge fleet on the way. And his kingdom basically gets completely obliterated almost instantly. Like the size scope is incomparable between the two. And then his in the Vagrant Gods, as you can imagine, gods are actually a fairly key and important deal in this. There are actually two deities that live on Thanet, and they have physical incarnations, and they actually fight the invading forces. And that's what the first chapter, you actually see the goddess Lycaena, who's this butterfly goddess who has like her wings and dress kind of meld together. And she's this beautiful arrangement of like gold and oranges and reds. And she like wields a scepter and flings fire at the soldiers. And there's also in Darius, this winged lion with like this rainbow feathers is super strong, and they're just doing their best. But even those gods can be killed. So it's not just his family is overthrown, his kingdom is taken from him. He literally watches his gods die, and everything is just about as bad as it gets. And he's just kept alive as a convenient hostage, because the goal of the Everlon Empire is they have their own gods that are worshipped, and they have their own system for their churches and stuff. And they are there to basically enact those systems, those codes, and change the worship to their god incarnate, they call him. And so he's just kind of kept alive, and vague hints and promises about how maybe he'll return to be in charge, not as a king, because they won't be ruling themselves anymore, but maybe like a puppet type of ruler, like sort of pretend that they're still in charge. And that's basically how the novel then continues on from there, as he lives under their control, breaks free, and as the back of the book makes clear, eventually tries to get revenge on this empire that invaded them and killed the gods that he had known as people had worshipped for hundreds of years.
And shenanigans ensue.
Lots of shenanigans, lots of fighting. It's very bloody and violent, as many people have already remarked.
And that's not always a bad thing. Sometimes when you have protagonists who have developed anger management issues and are driven by the pure white hot fire of fury, they're not going to hold back. The restraint is not in their vocabulary, not until they've worked some things through, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that if you grab a book with like a solid black cover with a white skull wearing assassin on the front, that you would expect some level of violence. The fun thing about Cyrus, the main character, is that you talk about like that white hot rage for vengeance. And the fun thing about him and what I want to do with him is that is a huge part of his motivation. But the idea is that that's not who he would normally be. He's very quiet. He's very shy. He's basically a bookworm. He wants to just sit and read. But he ends up getting drawn into, basically this empire has been invading lots of different places and expanding over thousands of years at this point. And there are like effectively resistance groups that are trying to fight back. And even if it's not in their own nations, in other nations, like in guerrilla warfare and uprisings and such. And Cyrus gets pulled into one of those. So he's being used as the figurehead for a new rebellion. Because the currently existing rebellion basically gets crushed within the first 3 years, and they kind of have to start from the ground up when they get a kind of an influx of people who have basically fought these types of wars before. Like they've led these insurrections before, and they kind of bring in Cyrus and go, we need you to be the figurehead. You are the deposed prince. You are the heir to the throne. You are, we're a bunch of foreigners that just arrived here. We can't rally the people around us. We need to rally them around someone to keep people, still fighting and believing there's a chance. It's got to be you. You are the one that makes the most sense. You're the one that, you're, again, the throne should be yours. This is about as easy as it gets to unite people behind. So we're going to need you to actually, be that figurehead. So he gets his training, and he wants his vengeance. It's a part of him, but it's like, he also just wants to be a fairly young kid still. I mean, the start of the book, he's like 14. I think he starts his official training at like 17, I think. And it lasts for like a couple of years. Because they're like, we need you to, the soldiers that fight in the Everland Empire, there are specific soldiers known as Paragons who have just complete inhuman strength and might. And they're like, we can't bring you back as the figurehead for our rebellion and then watch you die in the first fight. That kind of doesn't work. So no, you need training. Which then gets you a nice, good training montage if you like those. So it's like this idea of someone forced to become what he really isn't, playing the part of this super scary, dangerous assassin when even his very skills are being highly exaggerated to the people. So he now has like expectations to live up to that are just very much not rooted in truth. So he's playing a charade of the super amazing assassin for what he believes is a good cause, but it shows that like the state of the desperation of the people who are fighting and the tactics of those he's joined who have showed up to basically fight a war against the Evelyn Empire, how far they're willing to go and how underhanded they're willing to be in what is ostensibly still a good cause.
And you had mentioned before, it's a little violent, a little bloody. What was there a challenge for you in writing some of those sequences?
Yes and no, because the Shadowlands series is what Orbit first bought and was like basically what really catapulted my books up into like being noticed. It's all assassins killing other assassins in these war between thief guilds, and it's all very over the top sword fights and backstabbing. So with the Blade of Faith, it's actually taken down a notch from that. it's not quite as absurd to where, because like with Shadowdance, I still had spellcasters and wizards and magical items, and the main character gets a ring that allows him to teleport. So he's literally like teleporting back and forth like Nightcrawler in the middle of a sword fight, which is a heck of a thing to try to convey in writing.
Yeah.
And like the main villain that they fight, the Dark Hand, has like rings that make clones of himself. So you're fighting like six versions, but only one is real, and you have to know which one to block when they attack you from all sides. So like, but this, it's Blade of Faith was actually a little more toned down. There's still like the main cast, for the most part, other than my favorite character Mari, they're humans swinging weapons, and they're just very highly skilled. The paragons that they fight against are about where things are a little different, where they're more superhuman level of in terms of strength, and you know they wear giant bulky armor. So they're where some of the complications come in. Anytime any of the gods fight, I guess that's where it gets a lot more complicated trying to convey that.
So when you are writing these books, what is do you have like a process, a formula you follow? Do you do outline first and then freestyle it, or some other method?
When I started some 30 books ago, I honestly don't know how many I've written at this point. I have lost count. 29 or 30 books years ago, I used to just wing it. I would write in order, chapter by chapter, had only the vaguest sense of where I was going. And then about a couple years into my career, it was clear that was just not working for me anymore. I started writing books a little bit out of order. I think the big breakthrough for me was the fourth and final book in The Paladins. I was having just a horrible time reaching the finale, but I knew how the finale would go. So I ended up just writing that one backwards. Like I wrote the ending scene, and then I wrote the chapter led to the ending scene, and then I wrote the post-final fight scene, and then I wrote the final segment of the final fight. I just wrote like 7-8 chapters backwards, and it's still one of my favorite novels I've ever done. I was like, okay, I don't have to write in order anymore. So I started kind of writing out like lengthy 2 or 3 page outlines, and then I would like kind of follow. And then at the point I'm at now, I go pretty much chapter by chapter in my outline, to where I will have all of the chapters listed in the book. All of the chapters have about 2 paragraphs describing who the point of view is, what's going on, what I'm trying to accomplish, what the key events are. And I just put them all in order. And I use Scrivener for this. So I can now see, I can mark them with colors so I can see where the point of view chapters are. And I can see if like one character is overrepresented or not, you know, a character vanished for 20 chapters. Maybe I should give them a point of view. And then just generally, I sit down at my computer at 8 in the morning after I drop the kids off at school, and I pick a chapter I feel like writing and then start writing and try to finish. And then if I, as the book progresses, I just keep slowly filling in these various chapters. If I'm unsure of a connection, like say I'm writing a chapter that takes what, yeah, chapter 20, and I haven't done chapter 10 with that character, and I'm like unsure how they connect, I'll leave little notes for myself to just double check it later during editing. And then as the book gets more complete and the chapters start filling in, I'll just keep kind of reassessing where the plot is and how it's going, and if I need to start adding additional chapters to address questions that are starting to develop, or if I need to remove a chapter because it's starting to feel unnecessary, and then just kind of keep going until all the outline's done.
Nice. Now, you mentioned using Scrivener to put these epics together. Did you start out with Scrivener, or did you eventually move to it from other tools?
I have done exactly two books with Scrivener. This has been like, a lot of times you'll write like, are you a pantser or are you a plotter?
Right.
And I basically started as a pantser and then have transitioned over the past 12 years to being a plotter. So like most of my books I wrote in Microsoft Word, but trying to plot out so many chapters in advance in Microsoft Word is not all that great. And even worse is when you try to add and remove chapters, that would become a nightmare. And just renumbering the chapter titles became such a headache as well, that eventually I started looking into just any alternative that could just do that type of thing better. And that's where I settled on Scrivener, when I realized that like you can actually have your chapters arranged on a little cork board as like note cards, and like rearranging the order of them would just literally just meant clicking and dragging it higher or lower and slotting it between the other note cards you want. Once I realized I could do that, that was just absolutely perfect.
Did you dive into any of the tutorials or the web-based classes, or did you just jump in and figure it out?
Oh, I jumped in and then promptly realized I had no clue what I was doing to a shocking degree. I don't know if you've ever messed with Scrivener.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, it's one of those programs that you can do so much with it, but you have to learn. So I loaded it up. I looked at it. I tried to fiddle around with it, realized I was making zero progress. I was completely lost. And then immediately went to YouTube and started like trying to find very specific guides of like, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I set my background? How do I view things as a note card? And just, it took me probably about 3 days until I had everything mostly set up to where I could write and things made sense and I could organize and whatnot. And now I just desperately try not to touch it to weaken it.
I get it. I totally get it. I'm still figuring out parts of it myself.
Yeah, I kept hearing dreaded talks of what it's like to eventually compile it when you're done. So that was also fun, because I think I used the wrong like setups, because when you obviously know, when you compile, you tell it kind of how it's going to set the book up and how it's going to order it and put in like, are these chapter breaks or whatever. And like, I used the wrong format like 3 times, and it didn't help that the first time I did it, every chapter was its own like mini sub file instead of just an additional text file like I have in the current one, which is way better. So I had just like layers and layers of files within folders that were chapters, and all of the formatting was wrong. And it took like a full day, because I wanted to edit it in Word before sending it to Orbit in Word, which is the format they wanted in. It was like a full day of just like going through and correcting all the weird editing that I'm sure is my fault somehow, but I am still going to blame Scrivener for it.
Awesome. Now, where can people find you online to keep track of what you're working on next? Are you possibly doing any virtual or in-person book events?
I don't believe there's anything scheduled. Yeah, I've got a few like miscellaneous and stuff. If you want to find me, you can find me at my website, ddowglish.com. I'm also on Twitter. I am that Dowglish guy. I figured that was the proper level of my name and informality. And I do have a Facebook page as well, for fan page, though I use it far less often than, say, Twitter. but I believe that is also facebook.com/David Dalglish.
Nice. We'll have links to all of that. The book is The Blighted Faith, first in the new series, The Vagrant Gods from Orbit. We'll have links to where you can acquire that book for yourself in, I'm going to guess, electronic format, print format, and audio, possibly?
Yes. It is also an audio, yes.
Awesome, awesome. And this would be a good place to start since it is book one of a new series. And David, again, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's Surveillance Fatigue has you covered. In every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama. From heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up because it's story time.
And once again, the book is The Blighted Faith by David Dalglish, out from Orbit Books on April 5th, so should be available, readily available right now. There will be a sequel. You keep your eye out on the updates and cover reveals from Orbit, both on Twitter and on their website. I believe the next book is due out in January or February, so we will look forward to that. But how about you? What do you feel about epic fantasy these days compared to 10 years ago, 20 years ago? Let me know. Give me a call. Leave a voicemail message at 602-635-6976 or shoot me an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. You can also come by the website, writersafterdark.com, and leave a comment in the discussion section for this episode or any of the other episodes you have listened to and have questions about. You can listen to Writers After Dark through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Player FM. And if you're listening on Apple or Stitcher or through Podchaser, leave us a review, leave us a rating, let people know that you are enjoying the show, and maybe they should take some time out of their busy podcast listening schedules and give this one a try as well. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently helping to support the creative efforts here at Writers After Dark and all of the other shows in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe, which include Slice of Sci-Fi, sliceofsci-fi.tv, Babylon Podcast, and I'm forgetting somebody, Charlie Jade, and a couple of others. There are some new projects in the works that will be coming down the pike. I'm going to say fall 2022, maybe winter. But we're going to be adding some more fun stuff. And hopefully you will enjoy it as well. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. Pick a tier, any tier, and you will become eligible for perks. Every month, I pick a winner out of the proverbial digital hat, and that person gets to choose from many of the review materials I have around here for all of the shows. We have books, we have DVDs, we have Blu-rays, we have 4Ks, and I simply do not have the space to keep all of it. So, the Slice of Sci-Fi Universe supporters get first dibs at some pretty cool stuff. If you prefer leaving a donation every now and then, the links to use for that are ko-fi.com/sliceofscifi and paypal.me/scifisummer. And that'll do it for this episode. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.